I got some advice also relatively early on in the process from Blair Levin, who's now at the FCC. And Blair told me, he said, you know, you've got to realize that in Washington, everything is a three-act play. You know, you set things up in the first act, and then there's various kinds of troubles, and then hopefully you have a happy ending. And so I'm also regarding this as a three-act play. And what I want to do right now is actually tell you a little bit about the ending of the play. And the reason for that is because it is a three-act play, I didn't want to explain it all at the beginning, because I feel like some of the ideas that I'm pushing are kind of a little ahead of the curve for Washington. Even when I started using that Gov's platform metaphor, I thought, is this too geeky? You know, but it seemed to resonate, and certainly the IT folks in the administration have picked that up. You know, Anish and Vivek, they like that framing. But here's the framing context that's driving this. This goes back, the last 10 years I've been on a mission. And that mission is to get people to wake up to the fact that the internet is becoming a platform, and that there's a profound significance to that. Back in 2001, I did my first conference really that was on this subject. I called it Building the Internet Operating System. It was, I saw that the conjunction of peer-to-peer file sharing, web services, distributed computation, being the early signs that we were starting to treat this whole environment as if it were one. At that first conference, Clay Shirky gave a keynote, and he told a fantastic story that I still love to retell. He said, we all know that Thomas Watson once said that he saw no need for more than 5 computers in the world. Everybody laughs, right? Because, of course, they know there's hundreds of millions, if not billions. And then Clay delivers this devastating punchline. He says, we now know that he overstated the number by 4. You know, and that is where we're going. And then what I spent the next few years thinking about, well, what was the nature of that platform? And certainly it had these technical elements to it, i.e., you know, that we were seeing the ability to have these web services and so on. But I was spending a lot of time thinking about what happened to IBM in its strategic battle, so to speak, with Microsoft in the PC era. And I wrote a paper called The Open Source Paradigm Shift, because what I was thinking a lot also about was open source software. And I came to the conclusion that what we could learn was that just as the personal computer was this revolution in commodity hardware, and that what happened was that software suddenly became much more valuable than it had been previously, and that IBM was blindsided by this paradigm shift in which hardware became cheap and software became valuable, which had been the reverse, the same thing was going to happen with open source software and the internet. So I wrote this paper called The Open Source Paradigm Shift about that. And it was really this idea that we were commoditizing software, many classes of software, and something else was going to become valuable. Clay Christensen calls this the law of conservation of attractive profits. And it was really in 2004 when we launched the Web 2.0 conference, which was really just about the idea that the web was coming back after the dot-com bust. And they said, well, some companies survived. Why? They knew something about the web that the other people didn't. And what it was became gradually clear to me. It was that users add value. But what they're adding value to is databases. And that what is becoming valuable are these vast user-contributed databases. And all the mechanisms for managing and understanding data are the source of competitive advantage. And this is, you know, this is the way that Google is to Microsoft, as Microsoft was to IBM. Again, IBM obviously survived the transition, remained an important company, but there was a change in the basic rules of business. So, here's the thing. Andrew McLaughlin talked last night about the internet as a vast decentralizing force, empowering the edges. That's true, but it's also very profoundly and dangerously not true, because these databases get better the more people use them. They have natural network effects. We're seeing people achieve monopoly in various kinds of and classes of data. And so, you know, Google being a great example. I mean, first of all, there's the trivial examples, eBay, critical mass of buyers and sellers, or Craigslist. Once you get enough listings there, you get more listings because that's where people go. Wikipedia, same thing. But Google is a lot harder to understand. You say, where's their, you know, their increasing returns from data. You know, I mean, after all, don't you know, Microsoft and Yahoo and anybody else who wants to run a search engine have the same access to the same data? Well, there's a couple of lessons there. First of all, Google is better at harvesting it. There's a story that really shocked me. It was a company called MarkLogic that put on, one day they dropped onto the web a database. You know, Yahoo and then Microsoft were selling ads to the highest bidder. Google would sell the ads to the best price. You know, they say this ad is three times more likely to be clicked on. We can sell it for half the price and still make more money. Because they understood the data, they'd mined it better. Now, not to rag on Google, but they're continuing on down a very dangerous path because they understand that it's about data and collecting large masses of data. They don't necessarily even know how they're going to exploit them. So you look at the Google book search, they just know that it's the data is valuable. But they're doing very specific things to gain advantage in certain kinds of data subsystems. Because that's really where we're building. We're building this internet operating system. The subsystems are going to be data. Things like identity. Who is this person? Or things like products. What is this product? You know, Amazon has some pretty good handle there. But also databases like speech recognition, image recognition. And when I look at the shape of the future, the thing that concerns me the most is that this internet operating system is going to end up being owned by one company. And the kind of operating system I want to see for the internet works the way the internet does today. That is, lots and lots of players interoperating. So the interoperability of data is one of the great challenges that we face today and that we need to take into account. We want to make sure that nobody has this, you know, increasing cycle of returns around some database that is super critical to all of us. So the cautionary tale that I like to tell is the one about Google Voice. Not Google Voice, the application, but Google Speech Recognition. Now, if you guys have tried the speech recognition on the Google mobile app, it's okay. But what's so interesting, when Google first offered Google 911, Google 411, which was just their you know, phone number lookup service, I said, oh, they want to get into the speech recognition business. And I actually knew because I'm friends with a board member at Nuance, that Nuance was trying to make a deal with Google. Google didn't want to talk. You know, they felt they could do it themselves. Microsoft, by the way, bought Tellme, another big player in speech recognition. But what Google did is they realized we have enough data, people coming to us for search, that we can start to collect voice data. They launched the Google mobile app. Again, they're collecting voice data. The voice data is getting better the more people use it. Right? So they basically leveraging their dominance of search to get dominance in speech recognition. Now here's the really, really interesting part. I talked to somebody at Nuance and they said, well, you know, speech recognition is unaided speech recognition, untrained speech recognition, but Google's isn't really unaided because what they're doing is they're cross-correlating between their Google Suggest database, i.e. their expectation. They know what people are likely to search for. So if you say pizza, they go, oh, you're more likely looking for pizza than Pisa, the city, or a piece of, or whatever. So you start to see again how the databases work together. And so I start imagining the future, and I start playing with things like, you know, training my face recognition on iPhoto 09 on my Mac, or they also have it in Picasa at Google. You know, where you say, oh yeah, that's my wife, Christina, and you teach it four or five times, and then it recognizes her face. And you say, oh yeah, didn't we used to do that with speech recognition? You know, we had to train it. And now I start imagining image recognition in which you also are able to cross-correlate with location, with social networks, and all the data that's out there. Jeff Jonas calls it context accumulation. And so you start to understand that these issues of identity really are data collection issues. And we are, in fact, going to have our identity owned by someone else who is able to collect, recognize. I don't think it's going to be very long before I could, you know, basically pan a camera across this room and get 30% of the faces, and then not long before I'll be able to get 50% of the faces, and it'll say, oh yeah, John Clippinger, you know. And this is actually why I think the semantic web is actually not the end game, it's actually a halfway house. Semantic web, this is the semantic web, but once I've shown it to you once, you know, you know, you don't need to see it again, right? Maybe you may see it twice or three times, but so that's the context in which I think the work that you're doing here needs to be put. The future is of enormous databases that get better the more people use them. We're building something that works a lot like our own brains work. And the crucial policy, I think the crucial policy decisions of the 21st century with respect to IT will have to do with who owns that data, what is the responsibility of the public interest to make sure that that's not owned and controlled by private interests. Thank you.
Hey, that's fantastic. They're right on the point. Well, next stage, what we want to do is have the different rapporteurs report out on their sessions, and we'll begin with the finance, transparency and finance. Where's Charlie? Yes, he's here. Do you want to? Yeah. Why don't you just? Pardon? Yeah. Well, stand and.
I am standing.
Wait, we got a chair. Okay. Well, he's a friend. So he was. It was Washington. Right. He was.
Okay.
He was a friend.
So it doesn't matter because I guess the mic doesn't work anyway. But is it working? Okay. It works. Okay. So in the session on financial transparency, I've kind of reorganized a little bit. I didn't understand all of it. So we'll, you know, it be reported. Maybe some other people will refine it. But essentially, what is the problem, you know, that we're dealing with? And, you know, we've seen financial collapse a number of times. This one, this most recent, was exposing some very serious problems of systemic risk. So, you know, how do we deal with systemic risk, which John Lichty, defined in three ways. I'm going to give two, which is defined as disruption of access to credit, or, and I like this, punishing the system over the firm. So you actually have something that's hurting the system more than any one firm. And use the example of Lehman's, I guess, $780 million exposure led to breaking of the buck, which led to a $2 trillion loss to the system. Is that
yeah,
close enough? So this one instance, which was an exposure of 0.04% of the ultimate damage to the system. So, and then he defined a number of risks. There is the domino risk, which is a firm like AIG, and they have counterparties, and you have to, if they go insolvent, then the people who were relying on their, their insurance would also go bankrupt, and so you had the domino effect. You had what he called the fire sale risk or the herd mentality, which is that you had certain toxic assets like the mortgage-based backed securities that failed because of untrustworthiness, got into the ratings. And then there's a continued lack of trust in any of these assets, so essentially toxic assets, which led to even a third kind of risk that Bob Lighten mentioned, which was the contagion risk, which is not only do you sell off the toxic risk, the toxic securities, but things that look like them. So it's sort of everything is kind of tarred with that brush. Then the question is, well, what about the SEC? Doesn't that solve this? And so we had a representative of the SEC.
Okay, you're on your own, Charlie. You're out of juice, literally and figuratively. What's that? Yes, he's acting out. Yeah, it came back faster than we thought.
Right. Yeah, I don't think that
okay, think that
was the
you're there, ready to go.
Okay. So the you had the SEC that you know started as a paper based data gatherer and distributor, went to eventually went to HTML, and now XBRL, the Extensible Business Reporting Language, as a way of bringing in information that can be shared across essentially a common language that people can then use. What are some of the ways that have been used to look at the solution of what amounts to massive transparency and open analytics? So we touched on Google Trends, which you know, by seeing what was clicked on, you can sometimes tell what's going to be risky.
Bob channeled him. Yeah, Bob channeled Hal Varian.
Hal Varian.
Right?
There was Free Risk has a system where you can make information available broadly and freely. You had Palantir, who has a very sophisticated system of, and they showed us mortgages, and you can dig down and you can tell what mortgages, what all the information behind the mortgages, what's connected to other, to what mortgage-backed securities. You can really analyze across the entire financial system, at least with respect to in their and what was in the tranche and what else, who else was, what how that was rated, what it could have been rated. Who else was involved in that that rating system? And that gets to the whole rating system. And it was pointed out, I think, Scott Cooper, who pointed out that the whole incentive of the rating system was messed up. You had the raters being paid for by the people being rated. And he's trying to move more to a what he calls transparent ecumenical subscriber-based rating system that he's trying to get to be a global system, could even be done in other countries. And then we got, wasn't in order, but I'm kind of doing it, to another approach, which is the National Institute of Finance, which is a proposal by a number of private people, and John Leek D from Penn State presented it, and he is foreseeing a government agency along modeled either after the Weather Service or the National Transportation Safety Board, which would, in the latter case, look at near misses and investigate them and say, what went wrong, what could happen, but basically have the government have another agency, again, like the Weather Service, that would be able to get a lot of data, keep it confidential if it's confidential, but apply major analytics to it. And he went into the needs for transparency and what the active research community could do to build new models to assess systemic risk. So what were some of the critiques? One was that firms have an incentive to keep information private. That's really the banks and all that. So this is going to be counter against their own incentives. It'll be difficult to come up with a system of having complete transparency. One answer, which was in the case of the NIF, the National Institute of Finance, they would be able to keep things confidential or would promise to. The second is Kim Tapale's point about power laws, that as you had more and more transparency and moved the hedging or the arbitrage out of the system, whatever those companies were doing by keeping that information private, that you were pushing down the margins, and that would push the business to the large capital intensive firms who could make it up on volume. And John suggested that edge networks might be a counterbalance to that. And then another critique was that, well, you you manage what you can measure, and that we might, there are two problems with that. One is you have the Heisenberg effect of once you start measuring it and managing to that, you are observing and you are impacting what's being measured. And secondly, that you would be managing to what was being measured and maybe leaving off what should be measured. So I think those, I guess if I were to have a conclusion, I'd say there was a strong consensus towards a greater transparency through common reporting language, open analytics, and building up the government's capacity to address and analyze data along the lines of the National Institute of Finance.
Great. Thanks. Any other kind of additions you want to make, comments, that are sort of clarifications, or? Okay.
That was marvelous.
That was marvelous, okay.
There was much more chaos in our
group. Thank you, Charlie. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, John. No, the library, because that was a key finding.
I support that completely. In fact, I was one who put it forward in the meeting.
Okay.
I was quoting somebody else. But I do want to bring up the point that it is true that we really have got the regulatory community outgunned with regards to what they can do and how they can analyze and what they can actually see in the future or actually be able to react to in an effective way. And we do need to have some kind of improvement here in terms of the data and the analytic tools. Otherwise, we'll again see the same type of repeat of the events that we've seen recently.
That's right. If SAC was a private company, they'd be acquiring Free Risk and Palantir, right?
Well, no, they're looking at different problems, really. And if you think about it, not only do you not have somebody who has a system-wide view of what's going on, because they don't have the system-wide data, but then we don't actually have the tools in them developed. If you think about trying to understand and model systemic risk, we have models that are good when the market is in equilibrium. But when you actually get into a stressed position, when you think about the model or the marketplace going towards potentially a new equilibrium, which is the event or the result of a systemic event happening, then you don't have models that actually are very good at modeling that. So even as a research community or an academic community, we can't really say very much about that. And the other thing I'd like to point out is that even though you may say that you can imagine the big banks not being willing to participate in this and actually give up their data and allow such a system to be built so it could be looked after and this economy could be watched better, they are willing to do it. We have several banks that are participating with us and willing to give up this kind of data.
I mean, on the positive side, the way I was looking at it, what I think is a very positive trend is this move towards open data, and you're seeing that as a movement, and then the analytics, extremely powerful, and that they're being democratized. And I was very impressed with the Palantir. I have not a stockholder in Palantir at all, but I just think that's a very impressive bit of technology that's very applicable to these problems right now. Bob, just sure. Yes.
Theory that it's all hopeless. But maybe one response is maybe you can use it yourself, but is we don't understand the frequency of earthquakes, but the government still spends money on trying to improve our knowledge of earthquakes. We are much better at hurricanes, but even there, there's room for improvement. But right now in finance, we're pre-earthquake.
That's right.
Maybe someday we'll actually be better than that. But I think it would be useful to use that sort of sequence.
That's great.
No one would say that you shouldn't even think about earthquakes. You should just give up.
If you think about the weather analogy, too, we spent 50 years having government, what would society building a capacity to be able to begin to talk about forecasts?
Part of the reason is we're in the knowledge of the physical world, and we have to do with that perspective that earthquakes and hurricanes affect physical resources. We talk about symbolic resources, but it's the CEOs, what stuff that exists.
Okay, one more comment, and then we'll switch to the next session. So you need a new institutional framework that's incentivized to do that, and that's in a hole that doesn't exist, and that's important to this. Should we then move to the, reporting out on next session on dispute resolution? Mary Rundle, here we go.
So we were looking at online dispute resolution, especially with government 2.0 in mind. And part of the aim of our group get-together was just to exchange ideas, but a main point we were aiming at was to generate use cases that we could actually work toward implementing to test out ideas. So we started out trying to frame what is a dispute. And the main point that emerged is actually this is a concept that's in flux. And the core idea to it is that really it's when trust is broken. And this, right now, we think of in terms of it's evident. People feel that this trust has been violated. But one of the things we need to be working toward in using these tools is to make sure that when people have no way of knowing what's going on because the code is so complex and decisions are being made by authorities that they have no participatory ability or no way to participate in the decision-making process, that they can also still feel that there's trust there. So how do you build trust into these technologies? We looked at why there's a need for new institutions. And again, the central idea there is for legitimacy, you need to have a participatory process. And it's not so important that the outcome is accurate, but it's that people feel that they can be a part of this. And in terms of the design principles then, it's factoring in the way that people normally make decisions in the real world. And experience in evolutionary biology and in other sciences shows that people make decisions in ways that are non-linguistic. So it's not a clear, rational, linear process that we might think, but instead it's your gut reactions to things and what are the patterns that you're comfortable with and familiar with. And you feel comfortable making a decision based on. These need to be factored into the dispute resolution process. And we need to allow for evolution. And part of this also is, again, visibility. People need to feel that they have a sense of what is going on. And so the more they can see patterns, an example was given of how if you're used to emailing with someone on a regular basis and they always email you back, they respond promptly and in a well-thought-out response, then you have a sense of confidence in them. That would never happen if you're dealing with me because I'm the world's worst emailer. But that in itself can be a pattern that you feel comfortable with. If you don't get a reply from me, you know you're dealing with me. Then in terms of who decides, there's the idea that crowdsourcing is what we want to be doing here. That's the central theme. And as part of crowdsourcing, you're aiming for large groups. You want large numbers, and you want diversity. And then there's the question of, should you go for a jury approach, where you're getting lay people who are not experts, or should you go for expertise? How do you avoid groupthink? You can get groupthink in either case. And also, if you're getting lay people or experts, there's no guarantee you're going to get a wise outcome in any case. So let's see. There again, it's participation, legitimacy. Allow for different approaches for different contexts. And you might want a layered approach. So for example, Wikipedia might have more of the jury non-expert participation in the decision-making at an early phase, but as things go up in the decision-making process in the conflict and as the dispute becomes more detailed, experts tend to get involved more. And then when we were turning to think about specific use cases where we could test all these ideas, there was the idea for peer-to-peer patents that Andrew talked about last night. Then there's health insurance claims. The idea here is that the very people who are part of the group who's going to be affected, so the group of insured people paying into the system, they can decide what's a valid claim or not. Another idea is the open trust framework that's been talked about this week, and building into the technology ways where people can have confidence in the system. It's not just a legal approach, but it's law combined with technology, combined with economics, combined with these various factors that come into play in society. Then another approach is the market. You want to avoid monopolistic behavior. And finally, after our session, there was a note that the FTC has actively called for technological approaches to having enforcement of the law, enforcement of people's rights. So this would be, for example, technological ways of enforcing data protection rights that people have, or also technological ways of allocating rights in user-generated content. So those were the use cases.
Thank you. Anyone want to comment on that or add to it? Okay. So the next session would be on private law. Monica.
So yes, our session was on private law, digital institutions. You might consider our discussion Act 3 of Tim's play, because I think we were looking at the possibilities, the sort of happy ending at the beginning, and then we moved on to looking at some specific examples of digital institutions. Then we were kind of brought home by the questions of jurisdiction and venue that are somewhat of a reality and a problem to think about. So we started off by hearing about the Vermont digital institutions work that's been done by Oliver Goodenough and David Johnson. They've been working hard on this at the Law Lab and at Berkman. In case any of you haven't heard from Oliver and David, they have it up and running. This is real legislation that has been passed in Vermont, and it allows people to register their corporation online and to conduct all of their transactions, bylaws, articles of incorporations, and to have online meetings, and to have those digital instantiations be the original for purposes of our legal system. And, sorry, is this working? There we go. The need for this, they sort of thought, were two things. One was that there should be a real digital platform for this sort of function. Oliver, in a previous session, had one time brought out a slide of what you get from LegalZoom.com if you order, if you try to incorporate from LegalZoom, and you get a huge package, which is a big stack of papers. So there's really no digital dimension other than the fact that you've ordered it online. Talked about how the digital world has allowed us to have wonderful one-shot transactions and a lot of space for peer interaction, but generally not for for-profit entities. So there was, he called it a big opportunity. I like the way he said it, a big opportunity for collaborative production and value in a persistent context. So that is what their efforts have, I think, given rise to. And we then heard from Charles Armstrong right here, from OneClick, and he has created, along with his colleagues, an online platform for collaboration for civic, what is the term?
Civil society.
Civil society. You know, they're from England, so they use those kinds of terms. Yes. I couldn't even remember it because I'm from here. But civil society, which I think is less of a legal structure for corporations as it is a setting for associations to work together. Am I phrasing that correctly? I hope. There is a legal structure. And it allows them to conduct their business online, have all their meetings online. They don't have to meet in person. So that has great promise for other organizations, for example, many nonprofit activities. One thing I think we also discussed in that context is they're going to have a link into things like Google Groups and Facebook Groups. And this will provide a sort of legal platform in which to work. But it brought about the discussion about this Cambrian explosion in digital institutions of this sort, which all of us are quite excited about, which moves us to the next topic we covered, which was the promise of what we might call cloud institutions. I like, John uses the word cloud law. I like cloud institutions because I think it's broader than the law. And the idea here is, where to begin? Institutions are something that we all depend on for transactions, and you know, my own personal two cents that I contributed to the discussion was that you know, through the work of people like Hernando de Soto, we've largely come to think that private property rights are essential to the development of our economies, and yet those take quite a long time, unfortunately, to develop. And one, of course, wonderful potential is to be able to sidestep the need to wait and to be able to opt into certain private institutions, but potentially also into law, perhaps of other countries, in doing transactions. And so hence the term cloud institutions, which is very exciting, but also fraught with, you know, road bumps. And so we then started to talk a bit about the reality of jurisdiction and choice of law and venue for disputes in that context. And we actually had, of course, the whole session on arbitration this morning. But Aaron O'Hara, who's just written a book called The Law Market, was able to give us a nice perspective on the way that outsourcing contracts have historically worked, where people were surprisingly not careful about including jurisdiction and venue and choice of law in their agreements, thinking that their contract itself was a set of law that they had wanted to use for their agreement. Not surprisingly, there was an uptick in litigation, and she then talked about some ways that would really improve that, which is to have a public law form as sort of the backdrop of a set of private rules. And that sort of gives rise to the $66 million question, which is how to orchestrate that and how the law might evolve to accommodate the new directions in which we're going. I'm sure I've forgotten a lot of things. It's hard to get everything in one thing. Does anyone want to add? It's perfectly summarized, I'm sure.
Okay, so these are personal recollections. Please jump in and correct me. So we kicked off the session. Drummond started with this remarkable news we've had this week of the government saying we want to rely on identities from private industry. We're not going to be an identity provider. Americans don't trust government. It seemed like a good fit then to have industry be the provider. And so Vivek's announcement, coupled with other meetings we've had at the White House this week, have been quite amazing. What Vivek is talking about is having some pilots. And the basic idea would be you could sign in to say, don't quote me, but maybe say whitehouse.gov by clicking on a button that says PayPal or Google. And you will be identified and recognized as a unique number, and no information whatsoever will be conveyed to the website. So that led to the really important underpinnings that made this possible, which is the emergence of what we call open trust frameworks. And what happened was, with the government interest in doing this, suddenly industry got its act together in amazing pace. We took the in common Trust Framework Federation, which has been used in higher education. And we cookie-cuttered it for OpenID, a different protocol from SAML and Shibboleth, and cookie-cuttered it again for information cards, and presented the government with three trust frameworks, which if you were good at search and replace, you would have been able to see that there's really only one trust framework concept. And that was, we were unabashed about that, and the government was delighted because it speeds the process of adopting these. So what we saw is the emergence of open identity is happening, and none of us in the identity industry who've been working so long would have ever expected the government would play a key catalytic role. I know I didn't. This has been a complete shock the last few months. So the policy theme that started with Drummond's presentation continued as always in all these conversations, the tremendous difficulty of balancing competing interests, the private, the need to secure the country, the need for liberties and freedom of expression and so on. PayPal, Andrew made an interesting comment about his biggest concern is actually not how the relying party, say the government, trusts PayPal, say, as an identity provider, but quite the opposite. He's more worried about the liability to the PayPal brand and what the government may do with the data that's being asserted. So the interesting flip there from the usual way we think liability flows. And he's not exaggerating. I've been in a number of meetings, and he brings it up quite forcefully, as always. So policy is the big wrapper, but there's another theme. I was trying to assemble these disparate threads, which was data itself. We can do a lot to secure data. Mike Jones, Microsoft mentioned zero knowledge proof and the ability to be able to make assertions that are not repudiable about yourself without actually revealing the underlying data, which sounds impossible, but it is possible. So for instance, you could prove you're of age or old enough for something without actually revealing your birth date. That's a very simple example, but that could be a proof. And IBM chimed in and said they also have that kind of technology. Although IBM was also, Alan was saying, we should expand this to not just think about identity of people, but also identity of things. It's broader than just people. Lynn Wells made some interesting points about, he was going to these hacker conferences and pointing out that the hackers are focused not on people so much as the data, and of late, especially the data in the cloud, because the dirty secret of the cloud computing stuff is the security aspects are not worked out, right? We're just making the situation even worse. Marshall pointed out that one interesting, and this is very near and dear to my heart, way to deal with this mountain of aggregating data is to have encryption so that the data may be being aggregated, but it's aggregated in such a way that only perhaps the user or certain people the user chooses have the keys to the data. So it may be stored at company XYZ, but if none of the employees of XYZ have the keys to decrypt it, then even under subpoena, all you can do is hand them, some random noise, and then it has to be correlated through other out-of-band connections. And while we're on the topic of data, Sandy Pentland was reminding us of just, and also Dorothy at AT&T, of just the staggering amount of highly identifying data that comes from the location-based. The fact that your phone has a heartbeat, it knows where you are every 2 minutes, and it's scary and yet fraught with huge potential for different ways of dealing with identity. It brings in the relational aspect of it. And to some extent that brings in one of the things that was mentioned is kind of a disconnect, again, Andrew from PayPal was saying, between the traditional way of thinking about levels of assurance and the NIST 1, 2, 3, 4 and one factor, two factor, and the reality is that you can, by observation of location, make far more reliable, higher level of assurance about somebody from just those data, and they don't fit neatly within the sort of prevailing paradigm of traditional, nice rational, linear, non-relational way of thinking about security, which is what we've been doing. Since this was about government, there's interesting, Eli Kahn mentioned that there's a process that's beginning now, and which is to really open up for revealing your identity and nor gaming the system. That's at one end, all the way through to the very difficult issues. Bruce McConnell was talking about securing the critical infrastructure and the .gov domain and credentialing and all that kind of stuff. So I have witnessed this in other meetings this week, this tremendous openness to not throw out all the good things that have been done in the previous administration, that I find amazing, and to be extremely open to adopting things from industry. And we just saw that with the announcement this week, those eight companies, you know, PayPal, Yahoo, and Google, and all these companies. And lastly, there was a theme around the emergence of what we might call a trusted advocate. Dorothy was talking about the need for user centricity, and you can combine that with the emergence of a new role. She was saying AT&T has mountains of data about people, but what we lack is a principled way to apply that, to monetize that in a way consistent with the person's freedoms and privacy. And of course, that just brings us right back to the overall theme that we started the meeting with, which is it's all about the policy. It's all about open trust frameworks.
Well, very good. Any additions or Alan?
I just wanted to clarify that the concept of identities as things, not isolated things versus people. Most of these new applications that are sensor-based, whether it's a smart home, a smart meter, smart grid,
right,
those things, have a very direct relationship to individuals. And so whether it's how they're built, or whether it's their privacy is invaded, or whether they have a denial of service for whatever it is, whether it's water, electricity, or whatever. So you're saying the continuum is broader than the paradigm of someone who's trying to buy something and it's that individual going after some particular service. The service may be coming at the individual. Say something like transportation, where your ability to drive is affected based on traffic rules and things like that. So just trying to broaden the aperture of the implications of some of the newer sensor-based applications that are coming down the pipe.
I guess one of the thoughts that I have is that, in an ideal world, we would have an architecture in which the data we generate is sort of owned by us in some way and anonymized as a result.
Yes, yes.
The reality is that of course, is out of the barn a long time ago. So it just seems to me that one of the interesting policy issues is to think about what would be the equivalent antitrust policy for data. Because the fact is, nobody's going to own all the data. But the question is, are the critical assemblages of data that when put together become so useful and so powerful that they give somebody really, really deep insight and effectively take away other people's rights or other people's privacy? So it's kind of like an understanding of the ontology that if you have somebody's location and you have this other data, for instance, that's really powerful, and therefore the same party needs to not own those two things.
Yeah, that's a great, great, great point. Sandy.
So I think the point about this trusted third party, which you just said, is sort of critical. I think that one thing we need to avoid doing is thinking that there's a technical solution.
Right.
There's really a societal, political thing. Rather than trying, though, to sort of have disaggregated things, you can imagine that you have a political solution where the stakeholders are all watching each other.
Yeah.
So that there's the tension, the political tension, that preserves the balance. So if somebody tries to exploit the data in a way that's seen as unethical, it's in the interest of
some other party.
That's a risk point. So just kind of exposing the fact of what's possible, and then you make certain things. Nobody goes there because they know that.
Because everybody else will go to retail.
Interesting. Interesting. So we're about ready to wrap up. Stephen Schultz, is he going to? Okay. Well, I'd like to thank Carolyn Nolan for her fantastic efforts and putting this together. You're really, really, really great job. A great dress, another staff. And so we're ready to break for lunch, a well-deserved lunch. But there's also maybe an opportunity to look at do you want to speak to this? You have a brief.
Open ID information product. yes, yes, yes. She's with the joint. She's the city TO.
Yeah, we. Yeah, her identifiers. Yeah. Yo. Yeah. Here. Why don't you identify yourself and so we can help them know who you are.
Just give me 1 second here. My name is Cecilia Fan, and I'm the joint staff CTO working for Emma Mullen Journal Cartwright. Especially, I'm located in the C4 system directorate, and our responsibility is provide all of the acquisition, the policies, the oversight of all the C4 system for the joint warfighter. And what we mean by joint community warfighter is all the combatant command, you know, and all the services in the military. And you can see that right now the key message, we've faced the information sharing challenge. You can see here that just an example of the 4-star and 3-star level. Every time if we have information, we have to follow the chains of command to flow the chain of information. So by the time that the big boss received the right information, all of that has been changed. So that's a challenge right now. That's a problem. Okay. 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 So that's the bottom line, the problem challenge we face. So recently, Emma Mullen, General Cartwright, and all our senior leaders have been going around and brief to all of the combatant commander that we need to move toward what industry call a network organization. A network in this term doesn't mean communication. Network here is network the organization, hyper-connected, network the people, the sensors, you know, the things, the agency, in order that we are not going to impact the chains of command. The chains of command is still in place, but we need to faster and change the information flow. General Cartwright once made a sentence that the decision to get all the perfect information to make a decision is indeed a very bad decision. Okay. So the next chart is going to show to the network organization, and indeed the term we use here is we would leverage on industry Web 2.0 or web-enabled organization. The same industry or travel industry, if you would like to go through Portal Expedia, then you'll be able to, from there, the gateway, to reach out, make travel, you know. So in the past, you as the individual is the integrator of information. Now the gateway, the portal, will be the integration of the information. It doesn't matter whether you go to Orbit or Travel or Yahoo, Expedia. It's transparent to you, the information is not going to change. So if United or Frontier, or in our case, if new future acquisition, a new system get in, we would like to make sure that the transparency to the user at the edge. The only change would be based on Web 2.0, based on information, the user interface, the interface to that new weapon or system will be changed, and then information will be accessed easily. And next chart will be the key chart that I would like to show to you. Now I want to move this. I want to go to the next one. Okay. Imagine that information here is the centers. All around the age, you have all the COCOM, we have joint staff, we have NGO, we have other government agency that we would like to exchange information with. In the centers, the purple disk right there is our own of our core common services. And what we would like to, right now, DISA, Defense Information System Agency, is leading to define what the core services is that will be common to all of the organization. And just imagine that that's the purpose. That will be, there will be where we store all of our information, all the data. Okay. And next, the RIN layer right now is on the application. Most application in the DoD right now locus in that blue circle. Okay. And last but not least is at the edge. You know, on the user, what we would like to do is on the user, whether it's an individual or agency, will be at the leading edge. Currently, the fastest way you might think that, okay, why don't I go directly from the RIN to the blue and get the application, the data I need? Why I have to go to the purple disk? But what we would like to do is in the purple disk, people will reach in and get information, and anyone have updated information will also update in the discovery in the purple disk, so that on the application, if add into that, people will be able to, from the edge, reach into via the application, via the blue layers, and reach into the center and access all the data. Okay, so I think,
thank you very much for a very forceful finale of a great conversation.
Indeed, that's my last line.